Welcome to the For Love and Money podcast, the show where business and social purpose meet to inspire a movement for positive change. Here's your host, Carolyn Butler Madden.
In this special episode on The Voice to Parliament, I have the privilege of interviewing Yes campaigner and Director for Australians for Indigenous Constitutional Recognition, Thomas Mayo. Thomas is a Kawarreg Aboriginal and a Kulkulgal Erubamle Torres Strait Islander man. He is the Assistant National Secretary of the MUA. Thomas is a signatory of the Uluru Statement from the Heart and has been a leading advocate since its inception in May 2017. He is the chairperson of the Northern Territory Indigenous Labour Network and a director on the Australians for Indigenous Constitutional Recognition Board. Thomas is the author of 6 books published by Hardy Grant and has many articles and essays published across the major media providers. His latest book is co-authored with well-respected journalist Kerry O'Brien, The Voice to Parliament Handbook, All the Details You Need. I will put a link to this book in the show notes. It is a brilliant book that really simplifies and clarifies The Voice to Parliament. In this special episode, I asked Thomas to answer the many questions that are arising from the proposal for the referendum for The Voice to Parliament. Some of these questions are legitimate, but sadly and frustratingly, many are born from a campaign of willful disinformation. This means there is a lot of misinformation floating around, and this episode is a chance for you to hear directly from one of the leaders of the Yes campaigns, where I put questions on these very issues to him. A healthy democracy depends on our citizens being well informed. Sometimes we need to get involved personally to protect our democracy. I believe this is one of those times. So I hope you find this episode valuable. And I ask you, please, if you do, please share it with someone else who you think it may also be valuable to. Welcome, Thomas. Thank you for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to join us on the For Love and Money podcast.
Thank you, Carolyn. I appreciate the invitation.
So this is a special episode in the lead up to the referendum for the Voice to Parliament. And it's to help our listeners navigate some of the complex questions that are coming up through this process. Before we get into the questions, Thomas, I want to give you some space to rise above all the noise and the questions and, you know, just to share a positive vision of what could be if we get behind Yes. What could it mean to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people? And also, what could it mean to Australians as a whole?
So the question generally is, you know, why is this important? Yeah.
Hmm? Yeah. So what's that vision? What's that vision of success? And I guess what I'm trying to get at is there was this moment in time, right, when the referendum was first talked about, where there was this moment in time where it felt exciting and it was an opportunity to unite Australians, to be the next step in our nationhood, to do the right thing. And, you know, now there's all this clutter and all this negativity and disinformation that you're having to tackle. I just want to give you that moment to rise above all that shit.
Yeah.
And go, this is what we're doing here. This is
okay. The vision for this has always been really clear. It's about recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in our constitution, something that I think a great majority of Australians agree should have happened a long time ago. But given we're Australians and we're very practical people, and given that Indigenous people understand that nothing else has worked, we've proposed recognition through the establishment of a voice, simply the means for Indigenous people at the grassroots, the people that are affected by the policies and the laws and the programs that the Parliament makes, to give advice to them to see better outcomes through shaping better policies and that. So, you know, it's a vision of a country that no longer has a gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people in measures of life expectancy, which is almost 10 years. We die 10 years younger than other Australians. We have more than twice the suicide rates. Proportionately, we're the most incarcerated people on the planet. Just the incarceration rates for children, for example, in the Northern Territory, and other parts of the country, almost all of the time 100% of the children in youth detention are Indigenous. So, yeah, that's the vision. Simply recognition and listening to Indigenous people for better outcomes. And that's, I think it's something that, should continue to excite Australians. But we have quite a job to do, given a lot of misinformation that's trying to muddy the waters.
Yeah, absolutely. There's misinformation and there's disinformation as well, right? Which is deliberate manipulation of information, which is very frustrating. I'm seeing you out there, here, there, and everywhere, speaking to communities about the upcoming referendum. How's it going? What kind of response are you getting?
Well, it's a really great response that we are receiving, you know, as spokespeople and advocates and volunteers on the ground. There's over 35,000 volunteers now across the country, and I'm one of many Indigenous spokespeople. And we're seeing a response of more yeses than noes in the phone banking and the door knocking, but we also see a large amount of undecided Australians. Our research matches what we're seeing at the doors and in the phone banking. Around 30% of Australians are undecided. And so that's what we will be focusing on as a campaign, is to help people work out what is disinformation and what is truth, to understand how this will improve Indigenous people's lives. And also another really important thing that we're trying to help people to understand is that a great majority of Indigenous people support this, because that's important to Australians that have goodwill towards us. They want to be voting with us and not for us or against us. And so we're just trying to help people understand over 80% of Indigenous people are voting yes, according to multiple polls. The process that led to the call for the voice in itself that concluded in 2017 through the consensus in the Uluru Statement from the Heart indicates also that a majority of Indigenous people support this. Because, you see, this proposal comes from a lot of lessons from a long history of struggle for Indigenous people. We've worked really hard for this moment for a long time. And those lessons are that we've had many voices before. And when I say voices, I'm talking about advisory committees, just like this one will be, such as the Australian Aboriginal Progressive Association in the 20s, the Aboriginal Advancement League, Australian Aborigines League, FACATSI, the NAC, the NACC, over and over again, Indigenous people have established, representation as is normal for large groups of people to do, to speak coherently to, the solutions to their problems and to take their people forward to defend against injustice. But the great lesson that we take from that history is that every voice we've established has been silenced. Where it's been established by one government, the next one comes along and takes it away. And that's wasteful. That stops the momentum for positive change and better outcomes. And so a constitutionally enshrined voice is about guaranteeing some consistency, and consistency is really important to getting better outcomes.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for saying that. And there are a couple of things I want to pick up on there. And that is, the majority of Indigenous people, I've seen two polls, 80% and 83% do support this. I was shocked when I've had people in my network say to me, why do 80% of Indigenous people not support this? And I'm like, whoa, okay. Yeah. So it's really important people understand that and can push back on that disinformation.
Yeah, the disinformation is quite sophisticated as well, in a way. It was exposed in an article in The Guardian that the No campaign was sponsoring two Facebook pages, basically, that are complete opposite. So you had one set of one page posting trying to disinform people that they're going to lose something from this, whether it was their farm or their backyards, all those, that sort of fear mongering. And then they were also sponsoring a page that was made it seem like it was Indigenous people protesting against this and saying that it wasn't enough, quite duplicitous, that disinformation is really targeted, designed to cause confusion. And, you know, I hope people listening to this podcast can help us break through that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why we're doing this. The other point that you made earlier was about the need for it to be enshrined in the Constitution. And that's a question that comes up a lot. You know, a lot of people are saying, why don't we just legislate for it? Why do we have to mess with our Constitution? And we know Australians are deeply conservative. So, you know, any change to the Constitution is met with serious concern and questions, and that's valid. But the reason, as you've said, is it helps you get above the politics, right? Mm. To have that consistency. And it's vital.
Yeah, we couldn't ignore those lessons from the past. That also, you know, when we have established voices, though they've had problems like ATSIC, and this is important to consider here, all organisations have problems, but you see, Indigenous voices have never had, our organisations have never had the opportunity to evolve, to learn from our mistakes as democracies, choose better leaders. You know, it just hasn't had that opportunity. So we couldn't ignore those lessons that our voice is always taken away. When we have a voice, we make great progress. When we lose it, you know, things are done that are completely unjustified or make things worse. So we need to reestablish a voice. But if we were to just legislate it, then we would be setting it up to fail, you know, and that's the importance of taking notice of the pattern throughout history that I talked about.
Yeah, and that's wasteful of time, it's wasteful of money, and it's wasteful of opportunity, right?
But also, Carolyn, this is a conservative proposal, actually. This conserves our democracy in exactly how it works. It's an advisory committee like any other advisory committee that cannot tell the parliament, force the parliament to do anything, cannot decide, you know, laws or, you know, where funding goes. That is still completely in for the parliament to do. And the parliament is more than just the government. It's the, you know, it includes the coalition and the Greens and Labor and the independents. It needs to go through both houses. So, you know, there is always somewhat through the way our Westminster system works, bipartisanship on everything that is done. This voice can't force anything. You know, it can't take anything from anyone. It can only decide what advice it gives. And it was an idea that was developed with conservatives. And in fact, some of the conservatives that are opposing this now, and they're opposing it for a political reason, not because this is anything that is radical or something that, you know, will take anything away from anyone, as I said.
And I think that's very clear to anyone who has followed this deeply, is it is political, right? It's just, you know, it's about FUD, fear, uncertainty, doubt, seed it to shore up, you know, to shore up support for your side of politics.
Yeah, and it's so unfortunate. It's so unfortunate, Carolyn, because if, you know, as I said, it was developed with conservatives, you know, it was developed with in mind to try and build a political consensus over something that was achievable, yet strong enough to be able to change, you know, what I don't think any Australian is satisfied with the situation in Indigenous affairs, those statistics that I talked about. And it's wasteful as well, these programs and policies that fail. So it's really disappointing that it was made a political issue by, you know, the front bench of the coalition at the end of the day. And it's mainly disappointing because if this fails, the outcome will be really harmful to Indigenous people and our children to have this generous invitation that I talked about that was made through the Uluru Statement rejected, you know, when it's such a modest proposal. We couldn't even achieve an advisory committee, you know, like really just to listen to Indigenous people.
It is such a, as you say, a modest and a simple proposal, and it came about as the result of a long and thorough process. Can you, I think one thing I want to highlight is, you know, we see the leader of the opposition pulling things out of his back pocket as this is what we should do. And I want people to understand that, you know, the process that this proposal has come from. Can you share a bit about that, Thomas?
Oh, yeah. Look, there's been so much hard work done, Carolyn, you know, for over 100 years since Federation, you know, Indigenous people have been crying out for a voice. There are many statements and petitions that lead to the Uluru Statement that inform it. The Akala Bark petitions, the Larrakia petition to the Queen, William Cooper and the leaders of the time in the 30s did a petition to the King. These petitions and statements, the Barunga Statement, they all call for a voice. So a lot of hard work done just to dust ourselves off every time these statements and petitions have been dismissed and ignored, and continue to seek, the simplicity of being listened to and the dignity that comes with that. But then that process that you talk about, after the silencing of that more recent voice, ATSIC, that was doing some great work, and as I said, it had problems, but it was never allowed the opportunity to improve. We saw the gap widening, and it was widening, you know, at a rapid rate. And so we Indigenous leaders called for an opportunity to go to our communities and talk about what form of constitutional recognition we could accept. And that call was done in the Kirribilli Statement. It was a meeting with the Prime Minister and the opposition leader of the time, Tony Abbott and Bill Shorten. And so they committed with bipartisanship to constitutional recognition, as had been bipartisan for, you know, until very recently, for over a decade. And they established the Referendum Council. The Referendum Council ran a process of dialogues where Indigenous people came together region by region, covering the entire continent and adjacent islands. And we did hard work again to learn those lessons from the past. We had passionate debate and discussion. At each of the dialogues, we elected delegates to take the record of meeting to a culminating convention in the heart of the nation at Uluru. And that is where we did 3 more days of hard work and came up with the Uluru Statement from the heart. To come to that consensus was really difficult because, you know, 270 people, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people from so many different places with so many different perspectives and experiences, from many different backgrounds and occupations and levels of involvement in, you know, advocacy, because there was a formula applied to try and ensure a cross-section of views, you know, so not just the loudest of our people that were used to being heard in protests and the like, but also the quieter advocates. And so we had to practice reciprocity, you know, we had to listen to each other. We had to go to Uluru with a willingness to reach a compromise, because the nature of consensus is it's never everything that everybody wants. You know, it's a compromise position that is reached. And we did that amongst each other. 20 of our people walked out on the second of 3 days. So there were only 250 of us remaining on the third and final morning. But what a consensus that is, you know, like that's a political feat that should be celebrated. We stood as one when the Uluru Statement was read for the first time on that final morning. And there were tears and there was hugging and, you know, our faces were sore from smiling, you know, our shoulders were wet from crying on each other's shoulders. And, you know, it was a moment of great hope that we would make this generous and modest invitation to the Australian people to walk with us to enshrine an advisory representative body. And I do hope, and I still hope, you know, we're only around 30 days from the referendum, probably less by the time this is going to air, but I have faith that the Australian people are fair-minded. We just got to do the work to help them understand the truth about this.
That's right. And that process, as you say, it's been decades in the making, but you know, the process that led to the Uluru Statement of the Heart has been over a decade in the making, and it has been rigorous and, you know, consensus building. And, you know, you really cannot, you cannot fault that process. So the other thing I want to ask you is, the Uluru Statement sets out the order: voice, treaty, truth-telling. Why that order?
Well, a voice, the voice is important because we can start working on improving things like housing in communities, which is a common issue across the entire country, in remote communities especially, health, employment and education. Infrastructure as well is a common issue across many remote and regional communities, just clean water, roads that don't bust a tire every 3 months to take your kids to school or to sport, you know, that type of thing. And so a voice is really about urgently getting better outcomes. Truth-telling has been going on for a very long time, and as has agreement-making. Treaties are already underway in most of the states and the Northern Territory, and that's with bipartisan support. Recently, legislation was passed in Queensland with support of the Liberal opposition. In Tasmania recently, the treaty process began under a Liberal state government. But they're going to take 30 or 40 years, according to experts. You know, it's a long discussion to reach a treaty over 200 years after first contact. And that's why the Makarrata Commission is important. That's proposed in the Uluru Statement to supervise the process, to support the process. There's fear-mongering about treaty as well. But what people need to realise is, just as the voice is only advisory, any treaty is subject to the Parliament ultimately agreeing at the end of the day. And no Parliament, no politicians are going to agree to something that will cause them to be unelected the next time around. So, you know, there's nothing to fear from a voice. There's nothing to fear from, truth-telling or the Makarrata Commission.
Absolutely. And I assume also voice was first because it was a modest step forward to almost like a no-brainer.
Yeah, advisory committee.
Who would have thought that it would create so much concern? So some no campaigners say that a voice will divide Australians by race, giving special treatment to Indigenous people. Are they correct?
No, that's not correct. The proposition is about having a voice, an advisory committee for Indigenous peoples. And Indigenous peoples aren't a different race. The change to the Constitution won't mention race at all, because we're not a different race. Indigenous peoples have a special connection to this place. I mean, who could deny that 60,000 years of continuous culture and heritage is something that is pretty significant? And I think if, you ask Moses, well, the fact that we still have bipartisanship for symbolic constitutional recognition, right? Peter Dutton himself has said, if this referendum fails, and he's trying his best at that, then we'll hold another referendum to recognise Indigenous people. So that's a great contradiction to his argument that this re-racialises Australia if he supports constitutional recognition. So Indigenous peoples aren't a different race. We have a culture and a heritage that should be recognised. And I think it's just fair that we should be listened to when the government makes decisions about us. You see, we are treated like a different race, Indigenous people. And a lot of Australians are unaware of the race power in the Constitution, Section 5126. And here's a piece of disinformation that you might have heard. Some people say the 1967 referendum that saw Indigenous people counted as Australian citizens for the first time, so an exclusion of being counted was removed. But they say that the 67 referendum removed race from our constitution and we're all equal under the constitution. That's false. The second thing that the 67 referendum changed was the race power. So the race power gives the power to the parliament to make special laws about any race, and pre-67, that was any race other than the Aboriginal race in any state, okay? The Aboriginal race. That part was removed so that the federal parliament or the Commonwealth now has power over Indigenous people in the race power. So since 1967, that power has only been used to make special laws about Indigenous people. In the 1990s, there was a High Court case, the Hindmarsh case, or Cardinieri versus Commonwealth, that determined that the race power could be used to make special laws, not necessarily for the benefit of Indigenous people, as was argued, but it could be used to make special laws to our detriment.
Wow.
So that harm us. So this race power is still in the Constitution. We're not equal under the Constitution. And Indigenous people seek a voice to be able to have a say about how laws and policies are made about us.
Thank you for sharing that with us, Thomas. I wasn't aware of that, and I'm sure most of our listeners aren't. The other thing I wanted to highlight is I saw Julian Lisa, who was the former Shadow Attorney General, who is a constitutional conservative and stepped down from his ministerial positions so that he was able to campaign for Yes. And that alone should tell people so much about what they don't have to fear. But I was just going to say, he says it really well. He says a voice to parliament is not about special treatment or privileges, but about getting Indigenous Australians to the same starting line that other Australians are at.
Yes, such an important statement. I was leafleting in Adelaide at a train station with Julian Lisa just last week, I think it was. And, you know, I think it says a lot about that even though we didn't get bipartisanship from the federal coalition, we still have bipartisanship on this. You know, here I am, a union official, handing out leaflets alongside, a conservative liberal politician. We saw Penny Wong leafleting with Malcolm Turnbull, I think it was. We saw Julie Bishop on the campaign trail with Tanya Plibersek. We saw Andrew Gee resign from the Nationals to support this campaign, and Julian Lisa, who gave up the shadow ministries of Indigenous Affairs and Attorney General to campaign for this. He's a great, he's got great integrity, we did do the hard work to try and bring all sides of politics with us, and that's the case. And I want to say to people, this isn't about who you vote for. You know, if you vote for the Liberals or the Nationals or the Labor Party, it doesn't, that's put that aside. This is a referendum about who we are as Australians. You know, are we the people of a fair go, as we say? And are we a country that can celebrate over 60,000 years of culture and heritage, or are we merely, you know, just over 100 years old?
Yeah. Are we people of the fair go, or are we the people that say, I'm all right, Jack?
Yeah, and not give a hand to a mate, you know, like there's few of us Indigenous people. A lot of people don't know an Indigenous person, but, you know, our children especially love our art and our culture, and they just have this innate understanding of how, it's our Indigenous culture and heritage that makes us unique in this world. And, put a hand out to us. You know, it's not special treatment. It's just bringing us up, to the same sort of level to have a say.
Yeah. It's about understanding there's a big difference between equality and equity. People have different starting positions, and we need to do work to do, you know, the right thing and what should have been done a long time ago.
Enjoying the podcast? If you're looking for more inspiration, head to our website, thecauseeffect.com.au, for more resources on how you can start using your business as a force for good. Or buy the For Love and Money book. Every copy sold allows us to protect one square metre of rainforest. Help us save 10,000 square metres by 2025.
There are people who are undecided. They're soft yeses, they're soft noes, and, you know, there are some legitimate questions. There's a lot of disinformation, but there are some legitimate questions that they're struggling with. So I want to talk to some of those. One of the things that seems to be causing the greatest concern to people is Section 2 of the proposed wording in the Constitution, which says the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice may make representations to the Parliament and the Executive Government of the Commonwealth on matters relating to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders people. So that matters relating to has some people very concerned that this opens the door to the voice influencing every policy, law, and administrative decision. What can you say to that?
Yeah, like any representative body, it'll only have so much capacity to comment on so many things. And of course, the voice is going to focus on the matters that those that elect the representatives want them to take forward. So it'll be their priorities. And their priorities will be matters around, I've travelled extensively for 6 years to many remote Aboriginal communities, urban and remote. And the priorities are health, education, you know, good employment, infrastructure like water and clean, you know, good healthy food that is not incredibly expensive. All those types of things are the priority. So if the voice was to focus on things that are not matters for the people on the ground, then, you know, the representatives will be unelected. But this is the most important point here, that if, just remember that this is an advisory committee. So if the voice did comment on something that, you know, has nothing to do with Indigenous people, of course the government and the parliament will say, yeah, thanks a lot, mate, but see you later.
Exactly.
You know, you've just wasted your people's time where, you know, you could have been, it's like we would lose credibility. Those representatives would lose credibility. They'd probably lose the next election, you know, because there will be set terms for the representatives for regular accountability. It's like, doesn't matter to anybody what it calls for, because it can be. But you see, the advice that it gives when it is genuinely, you know, from the people that are most affected, that is fully informed through processes that the voice will run to make sure that these are genuinely the best solutions that the people can put up, that will hold great weight. And it'll be something that, where a government decides to ignore that advice, then if it causes harm and the gap continues to widen, for example, in that area, then the voice, of course, will raise it transparently and say, we have given this advice to the government a year or, you know, 5 years ago. Since then, things have gotten worse. We're bringing this to the Australian people's attention, and then you can judge them at the next election. And that's democracy.
That's how a democracy operates.
It strengthens our democracy.
Yeah, we're not weakening it, we're strengthening it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The other concern I've heard relates to the lack of detail proposed for the wording in the Constitution. Why does it lack specific detail into how it should operate?
Yeah, well, it's important for people to understand how our Constitution works to answer this question. You know, I've got my phone here. The Constitution is about this size, you know, and probably a bit thinner than this phone. It is a small document, the size of a passport. The Constitution hasn't got all of the details, the mechanics on how things work, because if that was required for everything, we wouldn't have federated in 1901. We wouldn't have a constitution. We'd still be blowing over things. And also,
we'd still be riding horses.
Yeah, it would be incredibly inflexible because to change the constitution, you need a referendum. So, for example, the constitution the constitution provides the parliament with the power to make laws about certain things. It establishes the institutions such as the High Court. It also as a separation of powers. The Constitution on taxes says that the Parliament shall have the power to make laws for the collection of taxes there, you know, along those lines. Doesn't say how much tax, doesn't say where the tax commissioner, you know, should be from and where the office is, or and again, if the Constitution would be this massive document that's inflexible and would still be, you know, would everything in it would be outdated because it would be too hard to update. So necessarily, another way to describe it is that the Constitution is just a book of principles. And we set those principles, and then our democracy, through democracy, we elect a parliament to do the work of how those principles are enacted. We hold them to account regularly at elections if they're doing a poor job, but they have the flexibility in that time to improve things and update things, because there's updates to tax law often, right, for example. So the principle that we're saying yes or no to here is recognition of Indigenous peoples and setting up an advisory committee so that we can listen before we make decisions about them. Yes or no to that. That is the detail. That is the
that simple, isn't it? There's a image in your book, The Voice to Parliament, that you co-wrote with Kerry O'Brien, which I found, you know, such a good, simple, clarifying read. And it says, our constitution via successful referendum would protect the principle that Indigenous peoples are recognised and consulted with a voice to Parliament. That's it.
That's it. That's the detail. So, you know, I mean, you talked about the disinformation that's trying to cause people to think and purposely misleading people about what the Constitution is and how these things work. I mean, those politicians and the No campaign itself, the leaders of it, they certainly know how this works. And they're just being quite dishonest in telling people there's missing detail. It's not the case.
Which is incredibly disappointing and frustrating, rather than just arguing the merits or drawbacks of it honestly. So I'd like to invite you, Thomas, to address questions arising from some of the disinformation out there. And I feel really awful having to ask you to answer
these.
That's
okay.
Of it's getting traction, right?
Yes.
So let's debunk it. Is it true that Indigenous people would have a right to veto legislation by having a third chamber in Parliament?
No. Simple answer, no. Absolutely not. I should go through what the change to the alteration of the Constitution is to help people clearly see this. It basically reads, in recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples as the first peoples of Australia, one, there shall be a body to be called the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Voice. Two, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Voice may make representations to the Parliament and Executive Government on matters relating to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. And three, the Parliament decides all matters relating to the Voice, including its composition, powers, functions and procedures. So I didn't hear third chamber in there. There's no right to veto in there. It's simply an ability to make representations. And the Parliament decides how, everything
yes.
about the Voice. So, you know, that third part is just complete and utter safety, that the Voice cannot decide anything but what advice it gives. That's it.
Thank you. Next one. The Indigenous voice to Parliament is unwarranted because Australia already has 109 Aboriginal agencies to represent Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
None of those agencies are representative bodies for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Some of them are peak bodies in health or education, for example, but they are supporters of this voice because they would like this voice to be able to take the ball up on policies that they need to improve health and education. The NIAA is often talked about, you know, that's a government agency. It's, you know, it's not independent, it's not elected representatives. So these are important points. The voice is something different to those. It would work with those organisations, and it would be able to improve those organisations, you know, the policies and laws that set them up, some of them, you know, and the frameworks that they operate in, to see more efficiency, to see better outcomes for every dollar spent. That's what the voice will do.
Brilliant. And some of those 109 agencies are not even actively working at the moment. We'll include a link in the show notes. RMIT fact checking completely debunks this. There are 11 First Nations MPs and senators in Parliament. Surely they can address these issues.
Yeah, politicians, should we trust them? Well, no.
It's not their job, is it?
No, at the dialogues in Uluru, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people around the country said, we don't want politicians speaking for us. You know, we want to choose our own representation. You see, the thing about this is that politicians, like Senator Price, that is leading the No campaign, she is selected by her political party, the Country Liberal Party. She is not accountable to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. She's accountable to her party, which is mostly, almost completely, that party, non-Indigenous people. So also Indigenous politicians are, they are responsible for the priorities in their electorates. And, over 170 electorates, all of them are mostly non-Indigenous. So, this is an important point to consider. Whereas an Indigenous voice will focus on, the health, education, employment, housing for Indigenous people. Finally, on that point, we don't know how many Indigenous people will be elected to Parliament next time around. It could be zero. And so consistency is important to improvement and better outcomes. A voice is something that will be around regardless of who is elected or who is pre-selected by their party.
Thank you. Let's go to the next one. Millions of dollars have already gone to fix these problems and it's not working.
That's why we want a voice. We need to try something different. Politicians, whether Labor or Liberal, or coalition, they're just not getting it right. And one of the reasons is because they are not listening. And if they are choosing who they want to listen to from Indigenous communities, then that skews things as well. They will be better off, our decision makers in this country, when they have an authority from the communities that can say, these are the solutions. This is how we can improve things and gain efficiencies. So that's an important thing.
And as you say as well, Thomas, like you mentioned how, previous bodies, when they've run into trouble, they've been cancelled, right? And I can't help but think of Robodebt and the Department of Social Security. Has anybody talked about cancelling that? Because of the absolute horror that was Robodebt. No.
That's right. I mean, parliaments or corporations or unions or other industry associations and peak bodies, they have problems from time to time. But you don't just get rid of them, right? You update the rules or update the constitution or amend the legislation to close loopholes. You let democracy run its course, and if people are breaking the law, then the law should deal with it. But this is really interesting, Carolyn, because also good, not just representative bodies, but good programs and good policies established under one government removed at a political whim by the next. Extremely wasteful when you've got really, policies and programs that are making a real difference that have just been crossed out just because it was set up under a different government. So this is not about who's in government today. Again, it goes to that consistency. It's about having a voice regardless of who is in government to defend good policies and call out wasteful ones.
That is so important.
And in that way, this will save money and save lives.
Yes, thank you. We're getting there. The representatives of the voice will be an elite group, unrepresentative of grassroots Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island communities.
No, I mean, to label someone that has done work, that has done great advocacy, sacrificed their own time, got educated, built networks, learnt, to understand the complexity of issues, and then is elected by their people to speak on their behalf, is suddenly an elite. You know, that premise is backwards. You know, it is really, I think, offensive to anyone that works hard. You know, it's as if we should all stay, you know, in the backwaters or something and never sort of step out and improve ourselves. It's such a negative thing to say.
Thank you. The more recent one that's coming through is, fear around land and property grabs. So, people are saying this is what you've got to be fearful of.
Go straight to the advisory committee, the reality that's all this is. For any of the fear-mongering you might hear about land grabs or, you know, forcing a farmer to, you know, pay millions of dollars to put, you know, to plant some trees, you know, all of those types of things are complete fear-mongering and false. This is an advisory committee. It cannot decide any of those things. Again, it can only decide what advice it gives.
Thank you. Not so much disinformation as what I would call an insidious eroding of democratic values. This idea that's put forward, and I cannot believe is actually in the referendum booklet, if you don't know, vote no.
My simple response to that is the height of ignorance. You know, to such an important question, any referendum or any decision by our democracy warrants people taking a careful look at it to improve our society, you know, and strengthen our country. And so please don't fall into this don't know, vote no thing. If you don't know, then find out, you know, and I hope this podcast has helped. And I want to say this at this point, Carolyn, you know, I respect every Australian's decision in this. And, you know, I think and I believe that we are fair-minded people, and there's great goodwill to Indigenous people and improving our, the relationship in this country and to close the gap. Disinformation is one thing, but, you know, being misinformed, I don't blame anybody. We have so many different priorities. This is one of the reasons why we need a voice. You know, we're busy people in our lives. We have great challenges, especially these days with, you know, the cost of living and climate, you know, the climate crisis and, just everyday life. We all have different perspectives. But I hope people will, reach into their heart and just do something that doesn't take anything away from them, but just helps others. A minority in this country, and it's about time, and I hope people will inform themselves and inform others, importantly.
Yeah, which leads me to another question. So let's move away from the disinformation and start empowering people. What is one thing Yes supporters can do between now and October 14th that could make a vital difference in this campaign?
Have a conversation with everybody you possibly can and do it in a respectful way. Make a list if you need to of who you can speak to. And I'd like you to, have respectful discussions. If someone listen where you can to understand the objection, and I hope I've equipped you with a whole lot of things that can help you handle those objections. If someone is entrenched in their position, though, and are a hard no and you cannot budge them, don't waste too much time. Accept that they're able to have their opinion and move on to someone that you might be able to persuade. If I could say one more thing, Carolyn, it's to become a volunteer for these final few weeks. So yes23.com.au is the website. You can sign up as a volunteer there. You put your postcode and it hooks you up with the local supporter group and the activities in the area. That is really important. And finally, donate on that page as well. We need to run a big ad campaign. We need every cent that we can get to reach Australians that are otherwise disengaged normally.
Brilliant. I want to go back to that picture before we wrap up that you shared with us in the beginning, that picture of hope, right? Can you share with us the feeling that you would love Australians to wake up to after the referendum result?
I really hope that we succeed. I mean, I can imagine the feeling, not just thinking about my own feelings, but so many of us to see smiling young Australians, feeling like we have really turned a page and taken the burden of a colonial past off their shoulders. The colour and the tears and the joy, Indigenous elders that probably didn't think that they would see this great step forward in their lifetimes, that have done so much work towards this. That's what I hope we see on our screens, and it'll be something where a whole lot of people that were might have voted no, they'll just continue on with their lives as if nothing, like when marriage equality got up, right? There was all this doomsaying and everything, but it was a moment that brought this country together that we celebrated and we still celebrate today. It'll be the same thing.
That's beautiful. Let's hope and work towards that end. Thomas, I want to thank you for coming onto the podcast. I want to leave the last word to you if there's anything else you would like to say to our listeners to close this episode.
Carolyn, I just want to thank you and your listeners from the bottom of my heart for listening. Listening is so important, and that's how we can improve many things in our lives by listening. And I hope that we all listen and improve our country on the 14th of October when we vote. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the For Love and Money podcast. If you'd like to take a deeper dive into the purpose movement, visit us at thecauseeffect.com.au. And remember, doing good is good for business. So if you're not doing good, then what are you doing?